The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Good morning, everyone. It's nice to be here this morning to preach to you today in the next installment of the sermon series, Keep It in Context. If this is your first time joining us here at North Pine, we have been going through different passages of the Bible that people often take out of context. Today we will look at Psalm 137. This is going to be a little bit different than normal. While this is often taken out of context, it is also just a difficult passage to understand and therefore leaves people not knowing how to interpret Psalm 137 and sometimes to just ignore it altogether. I will warn you ahead of time, we are going to get a little bit technical. But we all here hope that you've benefited from this process and have developed a hunger to better understand the Bible through exploring the context of the Bible. If you want to do this on your own and you want to give it a go and don't know where to start, just break into Alan's office while he's away. Take some of his books. I doubt he would notice any missing. The amount he has is mind-boggling. I've already done it. Sorry. Before we get into it, though, I did just want to touch on one principle that I think many people forget when reading the Bible. When we read the Bible, it is crucial to remember that the Bible is written for us, but not to us. This distinction is significant. Yes, the Bible is for our benefit and wisdom today, but the authors could not have expected the different languages their words would get translated into. They could not predict the different cultures the Bible would reach, and they could not write it in a way that catered for all of these considerations. They could not make accommodations for an audience that they could not expect. Let me give you an example of this even amongst people in the same time speaking the same language. If I was sitting in my living room with my wife Sarah and my daughter Torvi, and Sarah asked me, "Can you get a BTL, please?" Who here knows with 100% certainty what Sarah would be asking me? This isn't a guessing game. Who would bet their life on it? Hands up, anyone? A BTL. Sandwich? In this situation, Sarah would be asking me to get a bottle for Torvi. We came up with this code because when we used to say bottle, Torvi would think that she needed that bottle in her hand right away. And she would cry until she had it. So we couldn't say it until either she had it or we had to come up with this code so that we had time to get it in peace without her crying. Now, if you thought Sarah was asking for a bacon, tomato and lettuce sandwich, you would have gotten that interaction very wrong. And this is the same as the Bible. It was written by specific people at a specific time, and it tells a specific story. As I said, they could not make accommodations for people like us today. We live about 1900 years after the most recent biblical book. We also live in a country they've never heard of. And we speak a language that did not yet exist when the Bible was written. Because of that, we must make sure that our expectations and use of the text align with the author's intention. If our expectations differ, we are no longer being faithful to the intent of the message. We would be left making sandwiches instead of making bottles. So we need to do a little bit of work to make sure we get it right. So let's get into it. Let's read Psalm 137 together. Beside the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept as we thought of Jerusalem. We put away our harps, hanging them on the branches of poplar trees. For our captors demanded a song from us. Our tormentors insisted on a joyful hymn. Sing us one of the songs of Jerusalem. But how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a pagan land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget how to play the harp. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I fail to remember you, if I don't make Jerusalem my greatest joy. O Lord, remember what the Edomites did on the day the armies of Babylon captured Jerusalem. Destroy it, they yelled. Level it to the ground. O Babylon, you will be destroyed. Happy is the one who pays you back for what you have done to us. Happy is the one who takes your babies and smashes them against the rocks. So on first reading, how do we understand this? What are we to think? Don't worry, I'm not going to put anyone on the spot again and ask them to stand up and tell us what they think. But here is a website, Debunking Christianity had to say about this psalm. Psalm 137 is written from the perspective of an exiled Israelite in Babylon, mourning the loss of Jerusalem. The psalmist is deeply upset and in verse 7 prays for God's revenge, asking him to remember what Babylon did to his people. The psalmist eagerly awaits Babylon's destruction. He even expresses joy at the thought of their babies being smashed against the rocks, hoping for complete and total genocide. Christians and Jews believe this psalm is inspired by God and that the children of Babylon are doomed to destruction. The Bible debunks itself. Its authors are nationalists, racists, and genocidal maniacs. Why would anyone believe anything else they say, since this is so patently obvious? This perspective is indeed challenging and disturbing. So how would we react to these types of claims after reading this psalm? Do we agree that this is a command or a prophecy about what will happen to Babylon? Do you think it's saying something else? If so, what? How would you interpret this psalm if asked by a non-Christian friend or even your own child? Would you have an answer? Maybe like many others before you, this makes you question the goodness of God. Maybe this psalm makes you feel a little uneasy and uncomfortable. But this does not need to be the case. By using a few simple tools, we can gain a better understanding of what this is trying to teach us about God. Now, three rules to live by when buying a house. Location, location, location. Three rules to live by when reading the Bible. Context, context, context. And if you're ever looking for a fourth, context. To better understand this, we need to consider three different contexts. The literary genre, the historical context, and finally the context of the overall narrative of the Bible. This helps us to avoid misinterpretations and ensures that we remain faithful to the intent of the biblical authors and ultimately to God's message. If you think three contexts is a lot and wonder, how am I meant to do that? On last count that I had, I found about 50 or so different contexts, and I pretty much stopped because my mind was going crazy. And that's across the entire Bible. So three doesn't actually sound too bad if you look at it that way. So let's start with the first context, the literary context. Psalm 137 is a rich text that employs several biblical poetry devices to convey its themes of lament, longing, and anger. The first one is parallelism. This is a fundamental feature of Hebrew poetry. It's where two or more lines reflect or contrast with each other in structure or meaning. Example is verse 1 and 2. Beside the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept as we thought of Jerusalem. We put away our harps, hanging them on branches of poplar trees. These verses use synonymous parallelism, where the second line reinforces the idea of the first line. The act of sitting and weeping by the rivers of Babylon is paralleled with hanging their harps, both expressing deep sorrow. Metaphor. A metaphor is something that is regarded as representative or symbolic of something else. You see this in verse 2 where it says, we put away our harps, hanging them on the branches of poplar trees. Hanging harps on the poplar trees serves as a metaphor for giving up music and joy. It symbolizes the deep despair and destruction of their cultural and religious expressions. This is a little bit like when a footy player says they're hanging up their boots to retire. We don't actually think they have hung up their boots somewhere. We just understand that it means that aspect of their life has stopped. The next one is hyperbole. This is the use of exaggerated statements or claims not meant to be taken literally, often to emphasize a point. We see this in verse 6 where it says, may my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I fail to remember you, if I don't make Jerusalem my greatest joy. The hyperbolic expression of preferring Jerusalem above the psalmist's chief joy underlines the intense emotional commitment to Jerusalem. The next one. Imprecatory language. This is when someone asks for bad things to happen to their enemies, usually because they feel a strong need for justice. This is seen in verses 8 and 9. O Babylon, you will be destroyed. Happy is the one who pays you back for what you have done to us. Happy is the one who takes your babies and smashes them against the rocks. These verses show strong feelings of anger and a desire for revenge. They express the deep pain and frustration of those who have been wronged. By employing these poetic devices, Psalm 137 effectively communicates the emotional journey of the exiles from lament and longing to a strong plea for justice. Understanding these devices helps us appreciate the depth and complexity of the psalm's message. But why would they be seeking vengeance? Why do they wish the children of Babylon to be taken and killed? Well, let's look at the second type of context, the historical or cultural context. Israel had just been defeated by Babylon and taken into captivity and exiled from their land. This is a punishment from God for disobeying his covenant, and it was not pretty. When we understand the historical context, we would know that the Babylonian army under King Nebuchadnezzar was known for its brutality in war. The destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC involved widespread violence, the sacking of temples and buildings, and also the killing of civilians. Understanding this context highlights the depth of the psalmist's pain and the cultural practice of lament, showing that this psalm is an expression of human anguish. The Israelites felt entitled to this land. It was promised to them. The problem is that they forgot it was only their land if they remained faithful to the covenant that God made with them. And the story of the Bible would tell us they weren't. But it's also crucial to understand the psalmist is not dictating God's will, but rather voicing the anguish and desire for justice felt by the Israelites. Interpreting these verses requires us to differentiate between descriptive expressions of human emotion and prescriptive divine commands given by God. This is not God speaking, so it's not telling us what God is going to do. This is a human author expressing his grief and desire for vengeance. The reason why the depth of revenge that they are seeking is because the Israelites had experienced extreme violence and suffering at the hands of the Babylonians. The act of smashing infants against rocks was a known war atrocity of the time. This horrific act is likely to have been inflicted upon the Israelites during the Babylonian invasion. And the psalmist's cry for the same thing to happen to their enemies is a raw expression of desire for revenge and justice. I think with this knowledge, we can forgive the Israelites for wanting. They have just endured something unimaginable and devastating if it was to happen to us. It's something that would destroy most people and most nations even today. But that was the point of this practice of killing infants in conquest. It was to totally demoralize the people they conquered, and to make those that they will come up against in the future tremble with fear. From this, we can see that Psalm 137, verse 9, is not an endorsement of violence by God, but an intense expression of grief and a cry for justice from a people who have just experienced profound suffering. This understanding acknowledges the raw human emotions involved in the experience that these people went through. The final context, where it fits in the overarching story of the Bible. When we consider the story of the New Testament, we have an insight into the significance of this passage that the original author and audience could not have known. They didn't have the story of Jesus and what he does on the cross to round this psalm out. For them, it is still left unresolved. For us, though, we can take comfort in knowing God understands this pain too. Because he has experienced the same pain and suffering of losing a child when Jesus was beaten and then nailed to a cross and crucified. Now, this is something we all know and understand. But unfortunately, I think we overlook the pain and suffering that God must have felt when Jesus died, because we think Jesus was sent for this. It wasn't really a surprise. It didn't get sprung on him last minute. Slides back. But I don't think this meant that it was easy for God to watch. When we read the gospel accounts of Jesus being on the cross, we see that Jesus cried out asking God, why was he being forsaken? To think that God's heart was not broken at this cry is inconceivable to me as a father. I think any parent here could only imagine the pain and agony that they would go through if they had to watch their own child be brutally tortured and murdered, especially if they had the power to prevent it. And this is what God went through. But there is a lesson in here too. While these people wanted revenge for what happened to their children, God does not. When Jesus is being nailed to the cross, he does not call out, God, do to them what they have done to me. God rejects the desire for revenge and instead offers salvation to the very people responsible for his death. When crucified, Jesus calls out, Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But it is not just the people putting the nails in his hands that are responsible for Jesus being up there. We put him there. We are all responsible for Jesus dying on that cross. And yet here we are, sitting in church, having been accepted into God's kingdom as heirs with Christ. God does not write a psalm calling for the destruction of Rome or the Jewish religious elite. He does not call for the death and destruction of the human race. No, he offers us all salvation. He turned Rome into the very kingdom that is responsible for the spread of the gospel to the known world. He used the very thing that had intended to put the Christian faith to death as that which spread the gospel all over the world. So when we place what we can learn from this psalm in contrast with what atheists have to say, it makes what Paul says to the Corinthians all the more profound. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. And that's what context can do with a text. It can take it from looking like God is endorsing genocide and infanticide to one that speaks of forgiveness and grace. It is no longer a psalm that makes us question the goodness of God, instead reminds us of just how good God is. So when we all leave here this morning, let us reflect on the raw emotions expressed in this psalm. Let's be reminded that God welcomes our deepest pains. He welcomes our hardest questions. He even welcomes our anger. Let us remember that in moments of despair, it is okay to bring everything before God, trusting that He is big enough to hold it, but then to also take comfort in knowing He has gone through the same pain and suffering that we have. Let us remember that where we might seek revenge, God offers salvation. So let's remember what a mighty God we serve. Let's pray. God, we want to thank you. We want to thank you for offering us salvation even after we put your son Jesus on the cross. You had every right to destroy us and end creation for what we did to Jesus. But because you are faithful and true, you did not bring our own destruction down upon us. Rather than flooding the earth with water, you held that water back. And you flood us with your grace and love instead. Let us remember this when we interact with each other. Let us forgive those who hurt us just as you forgive us when we hurt you. Let us act as your image here on earth and give people a glimpse of what your kingdom will look like when you come in the fullness of your glory on those final days. Let us take comfort in knowing that despite the fallenness and brokenness of this world, you did not excuse yourself from it. You did not escape from it, and you did not hide yourself from it. But rather you entered it, you experienced it, and you felt it. And you did this so that we could be offered salvation and eternal life with you when your kingdom returns. You truly are worthy to be praised. And everyone said, Amen.
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.